And welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Feature. I have a fabulous guest. This film, The Luring, is great. It's an homage to something, I think, but we'll get into that. Christopher Wells, the director's here. Are you the writer, too?
Yeah, I'm the writer.
So writer, director, I don't know, amazing, whatever, let's go. Welcome.
How you doing?
I'm good. I guess I have to start at the beginning. Are you homaging anything here, or am I just reading into it?
Am I moshing?
Homaging, like homage to Stephen King?
A little bit, yeah. But okay. I was more influenced by the short film, The Red Balloon, the French short film in 1957.
Oh,
yeah, because when I saw that as a kid, it kind of affected me a lot because I thought, okay, it's a sweet little story, but this inanimate object is following this little kid. And I always thought that that was a little, not creepy, but I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if it was creepy, if there was an evil implication behind this balloon? And when I got the chance to shoot this film, The Luring, that's what I used as my kind of my main thing, my main influence. Because I wanted to know, okay, well, if I was going to create an evil world behind this balloon, what would that look like? What would that be? Like, who would be pulling those strings? And what circumstances would you know, be surrounding this? And that's why I have Garrett, the protagonist, you know, he's affected by something when he's a kid. So it all goes back to just using the red balloon as like my North Star. But yeah, Stephen King definitely had an influence as well.
Well, I was thinking unique things. That's where I was going.
Unique things is I never heard of that.
Oh, it's a little town and people have to keep getting things. And every time they get something, they have to pay the devil back.
Oh, wow. Okay. I never saw that.
Okay. Then don't worry about it. That's where I was reading. It doesn't matter. Your film's got, I mean, every film you could draw to something else. So I don't want to say, okay, enough of that. Let's get into your film. I want to go the opening and closing of the door right at the beginning. Were you pulling that with a string or is that wind or how are you doing that?
With the balloon? Yeah, I actually thought of an idea if I had a fishing line because it's kind of invisible. And so what we did was we pulled it out of the door and then we let it kind of fly away, but then we did a green screen when you kind of see it from afar. And then when it kind of returns, I don't know if we just did it. Yeah, we just pulled it back. So we were kind of pulling it. Yeah, it's been a while, but yeah, we were just pulling it with a old, you know, fishing line.
Interesting. So I was thinking that, was there more than, how many balloons did you have? I guess is one of my questions. Because I figured you had to have more than one.
Yeah, no, we did, but we were running out. And the funny thing is, before we shot the film, Brian, my other producer, said, you know that there's a shortage on helium. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, it might be a problem. And I thought, what? Like, thank God we didn't run into that problem. But like the fact that he somehow read that there might be a shortage on helium, I thought, wow, that's such a Murphy's Law type of thing, because obviously we needed it. And we bought like a big tank of helium just in case. We didn't need, you know, practically more than 80% of it. But yeah, we went through quite a bit of balloons because there was also a scene at the end with that little kid at the swing set. He kept unfortunately letting go of it because, you know.
Oh, no.
So we were like, oh, shit, we only have like two of these. I'm like, you know, what are we going to do? So we had to be very careful with that. But yeah, it's kind of funny like how you don't even think about things like that until you're, you know, shooting.
Okay, I'm going to, since we're going to the little kid, I was going to get there later, but we'll start there. How was working with kids? Cause, I mean, you have two, I mean, the scene at the end is probably a little easier to manage, I think.
Yeah.
But you had a big birthday party with a lot of kids to manage.
Yeah.
That I thought would be a little more difficult to do.
They were actually really well-behaved and great to work with. Their parents were awesome. You know, we shot that in Vermont. The weird thing is, when we were looking for kids, you'd think it'd be easy. You know, I live in New York City. If you're in a big city like Philadelphia or Boston, you could find actors. But we actually reached out to some acting groups and they didn't even reply. Like, that's just they don't have like that mentality of like, okay, get things done. And so it was a challenge just to get kids because it just isn't so, it's not as easy as you would think, you know, coming from a
I
big city.
agree.
Yeah. And so that was like a problem. Because we were like, oh shit, like we're like the week before we were going to production, we didn't have anybody. And so thankfully we were able to get those kids and they were great. And we try to feature them as much as we could because, you know, they were local. I think they were all from Lynnonville and St. Johnsbury, Vermont. But they were great. I mean, they were really good. No complaints. You know, knew what to do. They took direction great. They worked with the other, you know, actors really, really well. You know, I know that dealing with kids can be challenging because sometimes, you know, they're kids, you know, but they were true professionals, very like well-mannered. So.
How did the parents feel about the, I'll say big scene, because I don't really want to ruin anything.
Yeah. So we had to make sure. Yeah. So in the film, people get hanged. I think that's the right way to say it. And so, yeah, we had a stunt coordinator on set, and obviously we had collapsible rope, and so they knew that like the minute that you fall off whatever, and the noose is around your neck, like it's just gonna there's just a piece of tape that you know connects the two ropes. So they were actually good. Like I was more nervous than the parents were. Because I'm like, okay, we're gonna start killing people, and this is kind of like really dark and really kind of like a psychological thriller, so it's a little bit more of like a head fuck. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse or not, but
You can do whatever you need to do.
okay. And so they were great. Like they were super cool with it, very supportive. The parents were on obviously on set every day. But yeah, no complaints. Like I said, I was more nervous for the kids than they were because it's a little weird when you're putting a noose around someone and their parents are looking at you. It's just a little strange, you know? But you know, we had a stunt coordinator. We had, you know, people there for just for safety. So, I mean, but no one got hurt or anything. The biggest thing was the guy on stilts. That was the biggest thing that because he was also on a deck, and the deck, since it was on a hill, so he was standing on stilts that were, I don't know, maybe at least 15 feet high.
I agree. He's so tall in that
Yeah.
shot.
Oh my God. And the deck and the hill, like, and when you're on stilts, I didn't know this. You have to keep like moving. You can't just stand still because
Oh.
you're doing your balance. And so that was scary because we were shooting it from the hill, looking up at the house to make him even look even taller. And like, oh my God, that was nerve-wracking. But thank God no one got hurt.
Well, he looks like 30 feet tall. In
Yeah, I
that
mean
shot.
he might be well over 20 feet. I don't know. I mean, because he's knocking and he's bending down on the second floor window. So I don't know, he was very, very tall. Those were like his taller stilts. And so yeah, and he had to walk through like on the other side of the house, he had to walk on the deck, which was kind of narrow when you're dealing with stilts. And yeah, that was very scary. But there's actually a clown college in Lyndonville right down the road from where we shot. So we were
Oh.
lucky to get someone that was from there. So
So let's back that up. How do you put the ad out for, hey, I need a guy in stilts that can hold a balloon? How does that work?
pretty much just that. You know,
Okay.
yeah, I mean you just basically say exactly what you want, what the situations are going to be. You provide photos so they know what they're getting themselves into. You try to really be as transparent as possible because the last thing you want to do, especially when you're dealing with someone who's, you know, risking their lives for the art, you want to make sure that you're overly prepared and over explaining everything. So that really helped because, you know, he was really gracious with his time and had such a great attitude. And I think we did a run through the day before or the day of, but we didn't really do too much. It wasn't like we had a lot of time to prepare. I mean, like the whole
No,
film
I
was
wouldn't think you
done.
would.
Yeah, the whole film was done within 4 months from writing, from the, you know, me knowing, okay, I'm going to be able to shoot this film. Let me know. I have to write a script, raise the money. All that was done within 4 months. So we
Wow.
really were kind of racing around the clock. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to give you an option. Do you want to talk about the dump truck or would you like to go over locations?
It doesn't matter. I'll talk about whatever you want.
I would love to talk about the dump truck first because I think it's such a big piece of the movie. Because you do focus on it early and then you bring it up later. So you definitely tell the viewer, hey, pay attention to this dump truck. It's coming back. So whose dump truck was it?
Well, that's always kind of like the question that I like to leave a little ambiguous
Okay.
because it's one of the actors, one of the kid actors said it's like a spider playing with its food before it eats it.
100%.
And I thought that that was such a great way to explain it. The whole point of the luring, or not the point, but the evil force uses certain things to lure you
Oh,
in.
sorry. I'm going to
And
re-ask the question. I want to
sure.
know personally who owns the dump truck. Did you buy the dump truck off
Oh.
Amazon? Or is it your, sorry. I mean, I got
Yeah.
it in the movie. I apologize. Sorry. That's my question. Who really owns the dump truck?
I do. So I bought it at the antique place at where we actually shot the antique scene.
Okay.
So, and I bought it there maybe a week before we were shooting. No, actually, no, I bought it before. I'm sorry. I bought it before we were shooting. I went up there to kind of like, just do whatever I was doing before I went back to Brooklyn, and I bought it then because I thought, okay, let me just buy it here. It cost me maybe $25, $30. And I only had one, it's not like, I had multiple. So if it broke or something happened to it, I was screwed. And yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful little vintage, little thing. The little logo on the door, like I think we scratched off because we were just, we didn't want to run into problems with that. And I still have it. I don't. It's actually over there in the, like, I don't know if you could see it. It's right
I can see it.
there. Yeah.
Very small, but yes.
That's so funny.
Okay, that's what I was gonna. I just had to rephrase the question. I got it in the movie. That's what I was
Sure.
looking for. Okay, since you brought up the locations, let's start. This is a lovely cabin. You call it a house and try to sell me it's a house, but
Yeah.
I felt it was more of a cabin.
It is, yeah. It's
Okay.
it was my family owned it since 1989, and when my stepfather passed away, my mom had to sell the house. She couldn't afford it. So I said, can I shoot a film there? Thinking I was going to shoot a short film. I ended up shooting obviously some, a feature. But I mean, we were the house was sold while we were shooting, and the new owners were doing their final walkthrough 2 days after I called the final cut. So,
Oh,
and it was,
wow.
yeah. So, and it was during mud season. So that's when all the snow is melting and everything is muddy. We had to put Ramboard all over the house. I mean, I was vacuuming every single night. It was pretty crazy because my mom, thank God, she had enough faith in me to have a crew not ruin this house. And thankfully the people that now own it, when they did their walkthrough, there was no damage or anything. And so thank God. But that was like an added stress because the house was being sold while we were shooting. And they actually bought the house before we went into production. And I asked my mom, I said, can you ask the realtor to give us a month? Because we shot it in 22 days, not counting the times that we had off. So 22 days plus, every weekend, whatever. And I asked, can you, May 15th, I think, was the last day that we were shooting. So May 17th, they came in and did the walkthrough, and thank God there was nothing wrong with the house. But that, yeah, that was not fun to have that added stress of, God forbid.
I guess I have to start at the antique store. That is such a gem of a place you found. Oh
Yeah.
my God, I wish we could spend more time there.
Yeah. It that's right. I believe that's in Lindenville or on the edge of Lindenville and maybe some other town, but that's maybe 5 or so minutes from the actual location. So the cabin that we shot at is right next to Lindenville College. And then you go down the road and there's like Lindenville High School, which oddly enough, there's a lot of foreign students that go there. They have like a program, I think, with China. So there's a lot of Asian students in the area, and then you hang a right and you're kind of close to that antique place. But yeah, that I've been going to that antique place for years. Yeah, it's they definitely got a lot of cool stuff and a lot of, and when we were shooting there, thankfully the we I don't know if we paid to shoot there. I think they gave it the location for free, but we bought a lot of stuff. Like, during in between takes, like the crew was, buying stuff. So they were happy. I don't even think they closed it. I think it was open, but if someone walked in, they knew that there was a film crew, they just were quiet. So it was, it's kind of like a sleepy town, so we didn't really have to worry so much.
Is the bowling alley in town too?
No, so that is north, very close to the Canadian border. We wanted to use the bowling alley in St. Johnsbury, which is about maybe 15 minutes away from Lynnonville, and that's the bowling alley that I kind of know about because my dad lived in St. Johnsbury. But no, the bowling alley. So they, for whatever reason, couldn't do it, and they were very apologetic. They were great to deal with, but unfortunately, it just didn't work out. So then we were like, okay, so what do we do now? And this is like a week before shooting, and we found that other bowling alley, and that one actually worked out better, even though it was like at least an hour from where we were. It was, and the reason why I say an hour, like you, there's no highway really to get there. Like there was a lot of like little roads you had to go that. So that's why it took so long. But that one just had more of like a retro feel than the one in St. Johnsbury, so that one actually worked out a little bit better. But yeah, but moving the crew there, obviously, you're dealing with time, and if it's an hour there, it's an hour back, and so that's 2 hours that you're like, you're eating, which kind of sucks. Plus, you're spending now more money on gas and all that stuff. And when you're making an independent low budget film, every dollar counts. So like you're like, oh shit, like then now this is going to cost us now $350 more than we didn't. We weren't thinking. So as a producer, you got to like kind of have to think
Oh,
like that.
absolutely.
Yeah, but it worked out.
I presume the bar and the bowling alley are the same place.
No. So the bar is actually in St. Johnsbury on Main Street, which just got sold to another, person, whatever. And when we shot that, we were using a fog machine like we do, in a lot of shots, like, a lot of filmmakers do that to get like that misty kind of look. And that set off the alarm. And the fire department had to come in, and they somehow couldn't turn it off. Like there was like a problem with the alarm. So like we lost about an hour. So we were like, oh my God. And we were chasing daylight because it rained 15 consecutive days during our shoot. So we're like, so we had it timed perfectly. We're going to shoot the bar, then we're going to go somewhere outside because the clouds are going to give us a little break and whatever. And that hour kind of like screwed us, but everything worked out, thank God, and everyone was very friendly. But the alarm kept going off, so we're like, all right, lesson learned. Like, we can't use the fog machine in environments like this because we couldn't, there was no door because it's downstairs. You couldn't like open up a door and have like a breeze to like clear it out. Like, so in between takes, it just kind of sat there, and which you kind of want because you don't want to now, if you breeze it all out, then you have to like start from nothing, and that's not good, that's going to take time. So, but that was a bit of a Murphy's Law thing that showed up, but thankfully it worked out.
Okay, you do the shot outdoors where they're sitting. I think it's on Muskoka chairs or maybe a bench. You're saying it rained for 15 days. You know when they're looking at the lake. It's a beautiful shot.
Yes. Yeah. They're
So
sitting at
how'd
the
you fit
picnic.
that one in? You're like, okay, it's a nice day. Let's go do it right now, or is that was planned when you were doing it?
So we were chasing sunlight with that. We got that. That was the first take because that's it was a oneer. So, and we didn't have any time. So while we set up certain things like the blanket and certain things, all the cast and crew were underneath like this thing at the park that just protected us from the elements. And we knew that because my AD was like, we're tracking these clouds, and we knew that we literally had 15 minutes to get the shot. Like, that's it. So I told the actors, hey, if we could do this in one shot, that would be great. I don't think I'm going to be able to get any B-roll or like, and I thought that that would actually look better, but I was now being forced. I didn't have a chance. Like, I didn't have option now. Like you, as a director, you always want to have at least options to get like some sort of B-roll. God forbid something happens. But we weren't going to have that option because somehow the clouds weren't doing what the satellite was telling us, so we had a little bit less time. And when we did the shoot, when we did the shot, they got it in the first take. Then I said, okay, let's just try it again, just for sound or whatever, just to have an extra. And that's when it started raining. So we really only had like really no time. And so the take that you see in the film is the first take that we did. The second take, it just wasn't working because it was starting to rain. And but in the film, like you see the clouds moving, and like it actually adds to the ambiance of the film. And that's one of my favorite shots because it starts out where they're kind of happy and it's a beautiful setting, but as you go in, the conversation starts to change a little bit, and so there's a lot of subtleties in the film that I'm very proud of because it's nice. I personally like watching a film that doesn't spoon feed the audience. I like little things that like, oh wait, and you're trying to connect the dots, like they're fun.
I would say you definitely, in your film, you have to wait till the end to connect the dots. And I was trying to figure out parts of it. I said, I just need this explained. And you do a great job. I don't want people to know that. As you're watching the film, there is no spoon feeding in this film. You can use your brain, but you're still going to have to wait for the last little bit to connect the couple dots. And I needed that. I really needed everything. And it comes together nicely in the last 15 minutes, I would say. And I was sitting there, my wife was trying to go, I need this film to come together. I want to know how this all links. I could guess, but I'm not sure.
And I think it's okay for filmmakers to have not every little thing explained. I wanted to explain certain things, obviously, but there's certain things that if someone thinks a little bit left of what I'm thinking, that's okay too. I think that there's I think audiences are smart, and I think that they don't want things like everything explained to the T. I think that there can be a little bit of ambiguity, but when you're dealing with a psychological thriller, I think it kind of lends itself to give yourself a little bit more breath as a filmmaker. You don't have to explain everything. Of course, you have to explain the key things because you don't want an audience to like, totally abstract of what you're trying to say. But it's different than a slasher. A slasher, you kind of like, okay, you like, you, there's no mystery to it. But that's why psychological thrillers are, to me, more interesting to watch because it challenges the audience a little bit more to pay attention.
So I gotta ask, because of the rain and because of your time constraints, did you have feel you were rushing at times? Not because you wanted to. Did you feel like, oh God, I'm running out of time. I gotta get these shots in.
I didn't. Oddly enough, I felt very confident with the crew and my AD. I didn't think that there wasn't any, because look, as a low budget filmmaker, you never have enough time. So
Oh, I know that.
you're always kind of like chasing sunlight. So this film, I felt like I had a little bit. I was always just an optimist, with this because I just was so grateful for the opportunity. I couldn't believe like it was like the greatest time in my life. It was my first narrative feature. I did a feature documentary before that, but they're totally different things. And I just was like a kid in a candy store. I just was so excited and so grateful. And so even if Murphy's Law would show up, which it did, I just thought of it as a challenge. I knew that I had people that really believed in the project, that really wanted to be part of this, and we always just came up with a solution. And if we couldn't get a shot, there was always a way to figure it out. There was always something. So I never felt like, oh my God, like I walked away from this thinking, shit, I wish I would have gotten this or that or whatever. Because anytime when I do any kind of shot list, I always think, what do I need and what do I want? What I want, I may not get, but I'll try to get as many of those as I can. And I don't think I ever felt like, oh shit, like I really wanted that shot, but I didn't get it. It all came together.
Okay, you have a lot of pictures in the house, cabin. And I think
Paintings,
I
you mean?
see some behind you.
Oh yeah. So my dad, the artist, is the artist of all those paintings in the film. And so his work is very tranquil and beautiful. And the documentary that I did was actually on him called Romantic Realism, The Art of Roderick A. Wells. And they're why I put them in the film, not just because my dad, I think, is a great artist, it's because they serve as sort of like a subtle distraction of what's going on. So in the beginning of the film, there's a scene where the mother is just entranced by this beautiful work and not realizing that something very evil is lurking in the background and something very fucked up is going to happen. And so throughout the film, we kind of sprinkle that in, like where people are just so transfixed about this art. And that's sort of like a foreshadowing in a sense, because like Garrett also looks at this artwork. And that was actually shot at my dad's house in Vermont. So my parents got divorced, but they remained best friends. So when my mom remarried, they bought a house in Lyndonville just so they can hang out with my dad, because everyone was like really cool. So I grew up very diplomatic because I had two parents that, thought, okay, we're better not being married. But since they were so cool with each other, that's how I learned how to have disagreements with people, like to always kind of be calm and be diplomatic. And as a producer, director, that has served me very well because, as you know, when you're on a set, sometimes tensions might arise and people might get, there's always, you always need someone to be level-headed who is, diplomatic and not losing their shit because that is just not a professional way to go about it. But yeah, but so when we shot the scene with the psychiatrist, and Garrett, that was actually at my dad's house. And the painting that he's looking at is me as a kid and my sister. So we were always modeling
Oh,
my dad. Yeah. So,
fascinating. Look at
yeah.
all the stuff. I noticed you had a lot of fun adding sound a lot,
Yes. I love
very
sound.
subtly, but if you're paying attention, you can hear it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's different. So, how was that fun for you? Like, did you know you were going to do that ahead of time, or you're like, nope, this scene needs something?
No, in all my films, I think sound design is so important, and it's for people like you that appreciate film, that actually pay attention. I'm not trying to be McDonald's and make, even if I'm making something ridiculous and whatever, there's still a level of like, oh, wait a minute, and I think sound is the best way to do it, because if you have bad sound, that's the first thing people notice. If you have very interesting sound, there's a small amount of people that will notice that, and that's what I like. And so yeah, sound design, I believe, should be subtle but there. And I always knew that that was going to be part of it. I didn't like know exactly how I was going to use it, but that's consistently in all of the work that I do, even in my short films. And but when we were shooting the film, again, we only had 4 months, and we were kind of like creating the budget as we were going because we didn't really have another way to do it. And I was not originally thinking we were going to have an original score until after we were shooting. I think we were at like the wrap party, and Sean, the guy who did the sound, he goes, "Hey, I have a friend who does sound design, he does scoring, and he really wants to get into like the horror space. If you want to, I can connect you with him." And I thought, well, I don't know if we can afford this, but let me talk to him. And thankfully we were able to hire him. So with the original score and the sound design, I thought that played well. And Sean also did the sound design. So he did the sound on set, and then he did the sound design. And also like with my editor as well. I mean, obviously there's a lot of, people involved with that. But yeah, sound design, I think, is something that I think filmmakers, a lot of low budget filmmakers, should take more advantage of, because I think it elevates the film. Not everyone's going to notice it because, only people that really are into film and paying attention, not looking at their phone while they're watching your fucking movie, are going to really notice that. But I think it does elevate the film a lot.
I don't know how I could take notes and watch a movie. That'd be tough.
Yeah.
You have a note saying, what I've wrote, after all the years, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to go into it more than that. Who wrote it? Who drew it?
Oh, you mean the notes that were okay. Who actually, I think it was one of our PAs who was an art student who actually drew that. And Lucas, who is the DIT and the editor, he may have also had a part in that, because my
Because you have two
handwriting is horrible.
notes. You have two
Yeah,
notes.
yeah. Yeah, I think it was between those two. And I think like I kind of drew like what I wanted it to look like. but you know, I said, here, you know, take it. But that was with one of the PAs and Lucas, I believe. And then they gave me a few options of like, okay, you know, this one, because the whole poetry Jennifer character, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a lot of subtleties with that, because poetry has a lot, the poetry is in the film, and there's a reason for it, and that's a connection of, again, I'm tr not trying to blow, you know, give it away, but there's a reason for those notes, and reason why
Oh,
everything is in
absolutely.
rhyme, and yeah, and so, you know, and how it's drawn, it, you know, like if it was too detailed, it wouldn't have worked, and yeah, yeah, because at the end, when that little kid is given a note, or he's drawing something, and he's drawing, I guess, what this person has told him to draw, which is a death scene, and he's talking to the nanny about how she shouldn't be sleeping with the father or whoever, like she's like a, you know, whatever. Yeah, that was drawn on set there, or on location, and it was actually raining then, and we thought that we so we thought where the kid is on the swing set to the end of that scene, with the car, they're same location but different parts of the school. We shot that at a school, and we shot that for free. And the guy at the school said, "Just don't let anyone know that you're here," because he was giving us permission, but we were on the DL, and like we had insurance and all that kind of stuff. So if a cop did pull up, like we were, you know, good. But he was like, since it's a horror film, and since, because he read the script, he's like, you know, since you're, you know, the genre of what you're doing, he goes, I can't li like give you permission, but I'm giving you permission. And so we, thankfully, but we only had one day to shoot that, one moment to shoot that, because, and we were trying to work that in between rainstorms. And so if you look really closely at that scene, it's raining, but not enough to ruin it. But we had to take the actors and put them under umbrellas, because it, you know, it was raining enough to get them wet.
Okay, one of your actors has a very distinctive color of lipstick.
One of the actors has a very distinctive color of lipstick.
I could help you out a bit more if you need more help.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I remember that.
They wear, it's a surprise to who they are later on in the film.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going to go into any further because that'll ruin
Yeah,
something. So,
it's
what
been a
might.
while, so.
Okay. Was there ever another choice of color there? Because I found the way you shot it in the dark, that it all seemed to work with the coverage of the face, the identity
Now I know what you're talking
covered,
about.
and that
Yeah.
color. I was like, was he ever thinking of another color? Because it seemed
No.
to blend so well with everything you're doing. So my question is, did you test this out ahead of time?
No. So we, but that was very specific, and I did talk to the makeup artist about that. That was very specific, actually. I think I just chose that color because I just thought it would be good for the character, and visually I thought it would look good. But I think the makeup artist also had some thoughts about that too, which is escaping me right now. But there was definitely thought behind that, because at one point, that's all you kind of see in a sense.
That's where I'm
And
going at.
yeah. So that was something that we had to kind of like talk about, and that was something that we definitely discussed. Like every little thing was discussed, even though it was a low budget, and I, you know, I was wearing many hats. I did rely on the input of my crew, and my DP Amanda was great, because before we went into shooting, I gave her a version of the script, and there was a scene in it that she didn't like, and I'm glad that she told me that, because after when I looked at it, I'm like, you know, she was right. It just wouldn't have fit the film. And I am a strong believer in a rising tide lifts all boats, and but I believe that that takes a village. Like a film is not just the director's vision, even though it is. I mean, look, when we're on set, it's my vision, but if someone has a great idea, I'm all for it, because it's a team effort. And I think it also allows people to feel that they have an invested interest, and they're being respected if their opinions are at least heard. I don't like, because I've worked with directors that, are kind of like assholes and they don't want to even hear it. And you're like, look, we're all here because we want to make this into the best thing possible. I mean, obviously you have to do it without stepping on toes, but I believe that I like asking for help and input because I'm only me. I can only perceive what this is from my living experience. And so that's something, I know we're talking about lipstick, but it goes beyond that. Like there's a lot of things that that you have to kind of approach and say, well, what do you think? Like with your experiences, how do you take this? How do you perceive this? I think that that's really important, and it's valuable to get something as, and I don't want to say, oh, as small as a lipstick, because it's not so small. It is something significant, and to respect the makeup artist enough to really get her input was important, because she definitely had really cool, interesting things to say. And so, yeah, I mean, I listen very closely to what they're saying. Now, of course, it's my job to make that final decision, but I will always listen. And usually 9 times out of 10, like I'm gonna go with what they're saying, because you surround yourself with really able people that are very smart and passionate. And once you kind of give them that freedom, that license to give them the input, to give you input, I think that now all of a sudden you have an elevated staff, not staff, but crew, because now they feel valued. And I think that that's so important.
Okay, I'm gonna go with the same actor, so you know where I'm going. The voice work from this person I find has to suit this scene perfectly. Now, if they have a high-pitched voice, I don't think it would work. It might be a little more squeaky for me, but I really felt you worked with this person to get that right sound. Because if that sounds not right, I think you lose the scene here. Because this is right after the lipstick scene comes out, you're focusing. And that sound of that voice has to be, you know what I'm looking for, the right thing. So, did you work with that person or they got it instantly?
Okay, so that's a very interesting question, because we did rehearse it in New York City, where we did the auditions and we did some rehearsals, and we had a very specific way to do it, because with that character, there's a backstory, obviously.
Yes.
And you're not quite sure if what you're looking at is a dream or, and
100%. I
yeah,
will
you're
give
not.
that. You had me guessing.
And so her voice was very, had to be very thought out, like, okay, well, if she's this person here, but kind of at the end you find out certain things, everything, like you said earlier, like things kind of come together. So we did of a certain voice, and she had an acting coach that she perfected, while we were, getting ready to shoot. So we're shooting that scene that you were talking about earlier, the first time that you see her, and I didn't like the voice. I thought, this isn't working. And what am I going to do? Because now, how am I going to tell my actress, hey, you've just worked on this for how many weeks, perfecting this voice, and I'm the one that told you to encourage you to go here? It was just too childlike, I guess. I don't know. And I said to her, I said, do you mind trying something else? She was like, what? And I, gave her some direction, and she did it. And I said, honestly, I think that's the way to go. And she did it, and she was perfect. And but that was at the 11th hour, I changed directions. And I think it's important, when you're directing a film, you have an outline, you have everything in place, but you also have to give yourself a little bit of room, because things might change, and it might change right when you're on set. Because yeah, you have the language of the film before production. But the language of the film develops as you're shooting, and you kind of like understand the pace and the tempo and whatever you're doing as you're shooting. And so I forget the day that when she came in, but it wasn't like on the first day. So there was like a certain kind of like energy that the film was kind of creating, and that voice, because she has to be so many things. Again, it's like a spider playing with its food. It's like, it's an it's a it's excitement, but you don't want to give too much away. There's a lot going on, and I think she did such a great job, and for her to get such a curveball and nail it, I think it was so just such a great job that she did, and I wish I'd like to see her in more films because I think she's so good. And if people knew that I threw her that curveball right before, we were on set, like has her makeup, everything. And I'm saying, and we're doing the walkthrough, and I'm like, yeah, that doesn't sound right. Like an actor doesn't want to hear that. And she took it with grace and did it and took input, and I got input from her. Like, okay, now this is the new direction, and I think it really was worth it.
Okay. What was in the presents? Because you showed me, I'm not going to ruin it. I'm fine. You have a closet full of presents. Were they filled with stuff? Because, I mean, you do open them later in the film. But at that time, were there stuff in the boxes? Was the stuff added after?
It's so funny that you asked this question because, okay, I also have to point out that when they had the luggage, was there stuff in the luggage? And the answer is yes. Because when I
Okay,
hate it when I watch a film and they're bringing luggage and you know that it's empty, it's like, just put shit in it.
I'm with you 100%. It drives me nuts.
I
Because
just
I
like just a
want,
little bit of
I get in
weight.
trouble from people for watch. They hate me when I watch movies because I analyze them. I'm like, that's wrong. I said, there's nothing in that luggage. They're like, what? I said, when you watch, you know, like me, when you watch somebody pick something up, they're picking it up wrong. If it has something in it, it gets picked up right. So when the presents are in the closet, it's hard for me to tell if there's something in them or not because they're stacked.
No,
So I don't know.
there was stuff in it because I'm a big believer in realism. And if someone's going to lift something up, like there's a like
Yes.
look, we've all had it where we open up the refrigerator and you think that your container of whatever is full and you lift it up and it hits the roof because there's only a little bit of liquid in it. And that's only like a liter of liquid. So imagine if it's luggage or a present or whatever, like there has to be some kind
Yes.
of weight. It doesn't take, and I don't
100%
understand
agree.
why filmmakers don't put shit in the luggage and the whatever.
You see it all the time.
And I just
I can't remember what I was watching the other day, and I'm like, there's nothing in that luggage. And the way they picked it up, I'm like, that's wrong.
I don't understand why. So with the luggage, I just had the actors just put all their clothes in
Perfect.
it. Because I think it's, when you see Garrett taking it out in the car scene or whatever, when they arrive in Vermont,
Yes.
like it's got a, and it
Oh,
has to have
definitely.
a
He's
sound.
carrying it right. I can tell that. Am I up there? He's doing it right.
It's so funny. And when you're dealing with gifts, a thing is with gifts, you never want to wrap them. You wrap it, but you always, if you notice, which I'm sure you have in movies, they always say, they take off the top. It's because continuity, and it's just such a pain in the ass to have multiple presents where people like ripping them open. That's just going to waste so much time. So you usually just have you wrap it where like everything, like the top comes off because, you can reuse it. On a bigger set, maybe they can, do the actual ripping up the presents, ripping it open. But in a low budget, you're dealing with time and money, way more than on a bigger production where you can kind of like burn a little bit more. Every little second counts, and so that's why you can lift the presents up. But there was always stuff in the presents in the closet in every scene. It's so funny that you brought that up.
Sorry, it's just personal things.
Yeah, it's a little detail.
I love the shot by the lake. Now, I was wondering if the house is a cabin is on the lake, or is that a
No.
different lake? That shot is beautiful.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes. I really just love that scene, not only because of the subtle nuances with it, but just the beauty of it, these beautiful mountains. But no, that's about maybe 20, 25 minutes. That's actually close to the school. So the end scene with the kid and the nanny, we shot that the same day that we shot the scene at the lake. So we were chasing daylight. So what happened was we shoot the scene at the lake. We only had like 10, 15 minutes for that. And then we went to the school and we shot that. And then it poured because it was raining during that scene. And then it got really bad. So we were like, oh shit. Because we were thinking, well, if it's raining now and it looks like it's going to rain more, are we going to have the time to get off the swing set and move? You know, it was like, you know, on the other side of the school. Do we even have time to shoot that scene? Like, and my AD came up to me and he goes, look, you know, I know that this scene is, you know, you got your A and your B part of the scene. The A is part when they're on the swing set. The B is with the car, but we might not have the chance to shoot B with the car scene or the car part. What alternative do you have? And I thought, I don't know if I could come up with an idea where everything takes place actually at this one specific location of the swing set. And thankfully it wasn't raining enough. Thankfully, like it slowed down where we can shoot that car scene. But that was, again, we were chasing, you know, daylight with that. And we only had like, you know, a few minutes to do every take. And even moving from the back of the school to the front of the school was like, holy shit. Like we were really nervous. We didn't know. 'Cause again, it was raining and like you're dealing with electronics and all this other stuff that's not supposed to get wet. And like, it just, yeah, that was kind of like hectic. And then when we got back to the location, we were going to shoot something in the basement and all of my mom's furniture was out and it was pouring. And she had like all this like wood stuff. And I was like, oh my God. So we had to like bring all the stuff in and make sure it was, you know, tarped or whatever. But yeah, the rain was it was a pain in the ass.
Okay, I want to go back to the bowling alley. Did you play with the lights in there, or is that color corrected afterwards? Like, I was trying to figure that out. I'm like, it's not a green screen.
No, so we do some practical effects like with the dimming of the lights to kind of, you know, let the characters be like in like their own kind of world or whatever. But no, everything is practical. You know,
Okay.
obviously we do a little bit of color correction because we shot it in log and then we put a LUT on it, whatever. But no, everything was lit that way. We wanted it to be colored and, you know, have like nice colors. I always wanted to shoot in a bowling alley because I guess I'm a big fan of the movie Dazed and Confused, and they have a classic bowling alley scene in that. And so I always like thought, man, I would love to shoot in a bowling alley. There's just something about it I just think is kind of fun. And because I like, especially in Brooklyn, like we have bowling alleys that are like, you know, very colorful and they play music and it's like this like psychedelic experience. And so this bowling alley, since it was very retro, like I wanted it to have like those kind of colored lights and whatever. So yeah, we didn't do much in post in terms of, you know, really kind of going crazy with the colors. It was really more practical.
Okay, yeah, well, you're getting on. I only have one question left. Which is probably a good thing. You've probably got things to do.
No, this is fun, but
Filming at night, you have one big shot at night, I would say. And we've already discussed the guy on stilts, so that's the
yeah.
shot I want to discuss. I'm not sure. I think you had some light hitting the stilt guy, and that was it. I don't know what else you added to that, because, I mean, it's such a low level of light shot. I'm like, that is difficult. I would not say that was an easy shot. I mean, you got a guy on stilts, you're shooting up, I understand that. And then you got to get lighting in. So walk me through that.
So there's two parts to the stilt guy. Well, three parts. There's one when he's on the field, on the property. There's one when he's on the side of the house, on the deck. And then there's one where he's on, you know, knocking on the window on the second floor on the deck. And so when he's on the grass, obviously, talking to my DP, we're thinking, okay, well, what would be realistic in terms of the lighting? Well, it would be coming from the house. But we also had a light to kind of separate him from the background from the woods behind him, like a little bit of like a rim light. And then when we were shooting him behind the actress, when she realizes that there's something behind her, we had some lights, obviously rim light and, you know, key lights, whatever. And then when he was on the when you see him knocking on the door, this is the exterior, not the interior. When we're looking in and we see him knocking on the window, that was pretty basic lighting as well. You know, I forget exactly how many lights we had, but it wasn't anything crazy because, again, we wanted it to look the lighting in the Luring is, I wanted it to be what would be realistic, you know,
I
like
felt you did that very well.
Thank you. I mean, Amanda did a great job and her, you know, crew did an amazing job, but yeah, but everything had to be like, there had to be like a reason and we didn't want to make it look something that like, okay, this doesn't look realistic. Unless like, we're doing like a lighting effect and we're trying to do that on purpose. But with the stilt guy, that was, and he's extra tall, so you're trying to light something that is way beyond what would be realistic in terms of, if you're living in that house, what would you light? But we also kind of thought, well, every night is basically like a full moon night. So like the lighting from the moon, type of, way of approaching it. So that was something that we kind of considered. We thought, okay, it's at night. Where would this light really be? Because you're not really going to have a light shining at the house. You usually have the light going away from the house onto the yard. So why would we like, how would he be lit? And so we put a silk and, kind of replicated like, the moonlight. And that was kind of like, I guess like his main light when he's on the deck. And that was how we kind of did a lot of the nighttime stuff. And one of the cool things that I think that Loring has, especially the nighttime stuff, especially when she's, looking for her keys and she's trying to escape, I love the patterned, like I love speckled light from tree branches. Like I just, to me, I just love that look. And there, we got some of that. Because we just basically just put a light behind a branch and we did it, but sometimes we would put a branch on a C stand to kind of get that speckled light because I just think that it just kind of adds texture and just I don't know, there's something kind of cool about that. When I have like dreams and I in my dreams I'm very I notice the lighting in my dreams for whatever reason, and so and it just kind of makes me kind of think of that because the luring is sort of. It's kind of like a dream in a sense. Like there is a little bit of a question. Like, well, wait, are they in purgatory? Is this like a dream? Is this a nightmare? Because nightmares keep coming up. Like, is this something like that's what I was talking about earlier. Like about being a little ambiguous. Like, of course you have to answer certain key questions, but some of these other questions, I want the audience to kind of have a conversation about that, like, or and to support whatever argument they want to make. Like, well, no, it's a dream because of this or that. It's like, again, you don't have to answer every little question. You want your audience to kind of like think a little bit and kind of be engaged in what you're making. And I think, it all comes to from the lighting to the script to the acting to everything encompassing. But yeah, it was a lot of fun to shoot. There was. I haven't thought about, well, I think about the Loring quite a bit, but this is a very interesting interview and you're making me think about things like I have not thought about in such a long time because
Well, that's good to hear.
you're very keen on certain elements that I'm not used to thinking about or answering. And so bringing a lot of cool memories back.
Well, I guess my argument is with you. You're the director. This is your baby. I'm going to ask you everything. I want you to come out of this and go, he asked me everything. There's nothing I didn't give him. So that's great.
No,
So
that's
that's
awesome.
all I have to give you, except for three fun questions. And
Okay.
since you tell me you listen to the show, you're prepared.
Yeah.
So your favorite film?
My favorite film. Oh, okay. There is a film that I really, really like, and I think it's called Funeral of Roses. It's
Oh, so I just got
1950s film Japan, and it's I think it's called A Funeral Full of Roses or something, and it is low budget. It is fucking phenomenal. It's about this trans woman or cross dresser in the 50s, and just a really great filmmaking, black and white, and just they.
Funeral Parade of Roses from
Yes.
1969. There you
Okay,
go.
1969. Okay, I thought it was in the 50s, but
So I'm just helping you out so people, if they want to watch it,
yeah,
that's the movie.
I think it's a great film because it's low budget. They do a lot of really, really interesting kind of things, practical, effects that are obtainable for low budget filmmakers. I think it's important because it's like when you watch like an Instagram person who's like really fit and they're doing all these like backflips and amazing things. You're like, and you want to get in shape. And then you compare yourself to that person. You can't. Just like when a filmmaker, when they watch like a multi-million dollar Hollywood movie, you're not going to make that because you don't have Denzel Washington as your actor, and you don't have the budget to, so why not watch low budget films that are doing really innovative things, and you can learn from that because that's something that you can obtain. And I think so that film to me, I think right now, I mean, like I have a million best films, but that one is, I just think it's so well done, and it's free on YouTube. You can watch it on YouTube for free.
Okay, you come home and you're hungry. What snack are you getting?
Oh, I mean, is this before or after I eat my edibles?
Well, I get, you know what? I'm gonna ask us after because I think that's a much better answer.
Because my favorite food is edibles. But all right. Well, I'm a vegan. I'm one of
Oh,
those.
okay.
Yeah,
That's fine.
my girlfriend is not a vegan. I actually like smoothies. So I make
Okay.
smoothies with blueberries, bananas, a protein powder, almond milk, sometimes a little bit of spinach, and it's
Wow,
like eating
healthy
ice
man
cream.
here.
It's
Healthy
so
man
good.
here. Eating all the stuff.
Yeah,
I guess
yeah.
my last question is what movie you would people don't normally see, and I think you gave it away off your first one. So
Yeah.
I'll ask you a different question.
Sure.
How do you find a movie to watch? What's your go-to place? Do you go to Tubi? Do you go to Netflix? Or
Ooh.
do you just open up the paper and say, I'm seeing that today? Well, the old days.
Well, when you're living with someone, you basically I allow my girlfriend to pick the movies. But when she's not around, I actually kind of dive into YouTube, and I'll watch like a scene, or someone will talk about a film. I'm like, oh, that sounds really interesting. Or if there's like a Facebook group that I belong to, like a lot of horror groups that I belong to, someone will like, talk about a certain film from like, back in the day, and I like to watch those films. I like to watch really obscure, low budget B horror movies. I just
Oh, we know that from your favorite film. I would say that's a film I'd never heard of. I'm quite impressed you picked something I hadn't heard of.
I'm impressed that you never heard of it.
Yeah, it'll be done. I'll be dealing with that in the next couple of weeks.
but yeah, I mean, it depends on the kind of mood that I'm into. It's also depending on like if I'm working on a project and if I want to kind of have some sort of influence, like if I'm working on like a retro kind of film, or I just shot a short film that's takes place like in the 90s, 80s. It's like a Hotline commercial, basically a mock commercial. So I kind of like was watching a lot of films from that era, watching like old school Miami Vice. Watching kind of things that are kind of like that, because it just kind of like feeds my imagination when I was writing the script, or doing editing, and kind of getting like little bits and pieces. Because even like when you write the script, things are not done. When you're editing, you have to think of like the look, the color, the transitions, all that kind of stuff. And if you're watching things that kind of help you fulfill that need or want to express yourself of that genre, like it just helps, and one hand washes the other. And so it really kind of depends on the mood and what I'm kind of maybe working on, I guess.
Yeah, well, hopefully this is a nice, easy answer for you. Where can people watch your film?
Okay, so The Luring is on Tubi. It's distributed by Indie Rights, so they have a YouTube channel, so you can watch The Luring on the Indie Rights YouTube channel, Google Play, Amazon Prime, and I guess there's some other platforms that it's on, but Tubi and YouTube I think are probably like the easiest places to go. Yeah, I mean, and hopefully, as a low budget filmmaker, every view counts, because we don't have a big marketing budget. So hopefully people, if they like weird, crazy, twisted stories, I think they'll like The Luring.
Thank you for your time and have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.